I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, a Boston conversation with global attitude, and sometimes a global conversation with Boston attitude. This one is a test run of a new format and a new weekly public radio show on WBUR Boston. We're considering the hometown with a new mayor after 20 years. What looks like a new era. In the land of the last hurrah, these mayor's races are markers of social history. James Michael Curley's Irish Wars with the Protestant Yankees through four decades in the 20th century. John Collins and Johnny Powers, and then Kevin White and Louise Day Hicks in Irish Wars among themselves. Ray Flynn against the black contender Mel King in the 1980s. Then the Irish Eclipse through the 20 years of Tom Menino. And finally, this year, in majority-minority Boston, you could argue it's the most globalized immigrant city in America, we had a final election between two very different Irish flavors. The favorite, John Connolly, who is here with us, was Harvard-educated and school reform-minded, but he was defeated in the end by the trade union lobbyist and recovering drinker from the working class and waterfront precincts, Marty Walsh. John Connolly, get us started. Let's assume you learn more losing than winning. Where is Boston today? And where's the town going in 2014?
Well, I think, you know, Boston is booming right now just based on people's desire to be here, to come here from around the world, to come here from around the country, and to live here. And we see that, you know, in a time of deep recession, Boston weathers it in fairly good shape. And that's not to say a lot of people didn't feel pain, but certainly compared to the rest of the country, that's our institutional backbone at work. Boston's booming in many ways, but by the same token, we face the challenges that all American cities face. We have a daunting achievement gap. We have health disparities. We have income inequality. We have violence. And we have just the persistence of that divide, that intersection in American cities of race and class. And so while Boston booms, there is a Boston that doesn't work. And that's really the challenge for the next mayor.
John, look back at this race. You were the first challenger in before Tom Menino got out. You had, I think, the clearest issue profile among all the candidates. And you were also the beneficiary of an old pattern that those Western precincts, West Roxbury, Jamaica Plain, Hyde Park, that sort of Washington Street, Center Street axis of Irish power usually beats South Boston and the Longshore precinct, shall we say, the Dorchester Avenue axis. What happened?
Well, I think Boston has changed, and I don't think that paradigm holds any longer, for starters. And, you know, you can look. I lost Hyde Park, and I grew up right next door to it. But Hyde Park today is a majority people of color neighborhood, majority communities of color, which many people wouldn't know. It's also a neighborhood that still has a real working class and a city with a vanishing working class. And I just use that as an example of a change Boston. I don't think we break down along those ward and precinct lines any longer. What we could see in this election were trends that didn't reflect what neighborhood you were from, and for the most part, but reflected much more demographics.
But how will we remember it even as sort of emotional history? The choice we got between you and Marty Walsh, and then what did the election of Marty Walsh say about us?
I think on the positive end, I see two good pieces. One, you had in the final two progressive candidates, and I think that is unlike other mayoral finals largely. You had two progressives that many people couldn't draw distinctions with. I would disagree with those who couldn't find distinctions between us, but you had two progressives with some distinctions that I felt were clear but maybe not discussed. But the other piece here was, every candidate here drew from across all of Boston. I had large support in communities of color, as did Representative Walsh. You go to the preliminary, and you could say I finished about 3,000 votes ahead of Charlotte Ritchie. I had easily 3,000 voters of color in my corner that day, but she had easily 3,000 white voters. And so I think we were seeing a changing Boston, a Boston that wasn't broken strictly on race and class lines. And while we, I think, long to elect that first mayor of color, we also saw a Boston where a majority-minority city would put two white candidates in the final and would ultimately make the decision about who the next mayor would be.
But let me tell you what I was thinking through the race. I mean, down the track in New York, it was sort of the luck of the draw and Anthony Weiner's exit and all this sort of New York complications. But suddenly, Bill de Blasio was hot as a pistol, and this triumphant mayor for 12 years, Michael Bloomberg, sank like a stone. And you, not only that, you had a complete change in the conversation. Suddenly, it's about inequality. Mm-hmm. It's about Bill de Blasio's beautiful brown-eyed, half-black son. And as I say, the zeitgeist seemed to move. It didn't happen in Boston. And I keep wondering why. Did it?
Well, I think that a variation of it played out in Boston. The race was determined because of issues around the inequality and income inequality. It didn't play out as starkly and clearly as it did in New York, where Bill de Blasio said income inequality, I think, every other word and phrase. But
he also had a plan. Give him credit. You know, we're going to tax or surtax on incomes over $500,000. We're going to put it into, extended school days.
And it played out starkly and clearly that way. But I do think ultimately one of the reasons why, and there were so many reasons, but one of the reasons why Representative Walsh is now Mayor-elect Walsh was that he managed to make a case to the voters that because he came from a working class background, he would do a better job representing working class Bostonians. And that, I think, in a sense, reflected the fact that income inequality and all of these inequities in our city were driving the decisions.
But I kept wondering, John, why? I thought we were being bought off cheap.
I don't agree.
No, but he didn't promise anything. There was no sense of a solution. Like, and I got to say, you didn't come back with anything like the surtax on super incomes.
Well, I disagree with that. I think what I talked a lot about was wealth creation in communities of color. I talked about new ways of empowering our poorest communities, our most underserved communities. I don't think it got a lot of play in the media.
But new ways of empowering, I mean, that phrasing never gets much play, John.
Yeah. Well, I was talking, I'll always remember the day in the final when I had 20-plus entrepreneurs of color endorsing me in Elliott Square, and my very specific plan around wealth creation in communities of color, which is to say how we're going to empower entrepreneurs in communities of color. And not one person from the media showed up because they were across town in Mattapan where State Senator Forey was endorsing Marty Walsh. And look, I give them credit. That was great politics. Those endorsements, I think, ultimately drove a wedge. But I felt I was putting a substantive proposal out. I had the backing of real people in the community who were going to be impacted by policy change around wealth creation and how we support businesses owned by people of color and women and really take a directional change on that. But it wasn't what the electorate was getting or what they wanted.
Come back to the luck of the draw in the Boston race. You were happy to run against Tom Menino, said to be an overwhelmingly popular mayor, as Michael Bloomberg was said to be in his time. You were ready to take him on, and it struck me, just hypothetically, that if you had all sorts of, at least arguably, all sorts of opposition that turned up against Bloomberg would have turned into your support. Am I making something up here? I what I'm looking for is a kind of swell of sort of populist eagerness to retire these mayors associated, if nothing, mainly with luxury apartments and a kind of demographic readjustment.
Yeah,
high price cities.
I think there's a Boston that is hungry for a change in the way we do things, and that is hungry to empower a whole new generation of talent out there. And a lot of that goes to, again, to empowering our communities of color, but also goes to empowering all of the techies who have made Boston home. It goes to empowering that new economy in Boston. And I felt that if I had Tom Menino in a one-on-one race, that I could make the case to a new Boston and that it would have rallied behind me. I don't think that this final election played out that way. Ultimately, I don't think that that either of us, to my own failing, ever fully tapped into the energy of a Boston that's sort of waiting to happen.
Why not? Well, in retrospect, I mean, would it have helped to talk about taxes, about equity, to talk about an inequality crisis? I mean, ours may not be as severe as New York's, but it's there.
Yeah, I think if we could have gotten more into the substance of all of these equity gaps in Boston, I do think I tried to talk about that through education principally, but I think we needed to talk about it more in terms of job creation, in terms of wealth empowerment, in terms of health inequities, all of these pieces. Yep.
Dare I say, John, I ran for mayor of Boston once.
I remember.
it was a lark for me, people said. I took it seriously, but I surfaced school issues it was on my, the only thing that gave me the slightest credibility was that I had more parent time in the Boston Public Schools than all the other candidates put together. I suffered for you mainly because I saw, you know, another school parent and education candidate going down. I didn't get anything like the number of votes you did, but was that a curse to talk about education?
No, and I do. I would do that again. I think it's the principal issue, and I think, you know, certainly all of the polling that all of the campaigns did reflected that education was the number one issue for all voters, whether they were public school parents or not, whether they were parents or not. I think to a degree, though, that folks were not hearing what I had to say on housing, on jobs, on the environment, on arts, on all of these pieces that matter to Boston because I became defined as the education candidate. But listen, it was the centerpiece of my campaign. I'd never run from that.
Hold it there, John Connolly. This question we're puzzling, and it's really about us, where's Boston, comes from the title of a brilliant little bicentennial film collage of pictures and voices of Boston as of 1976, almost 40 years ago. Listen to the varieties of Boston just yesterday, starting with the voice of the poet David McCord. It makes you wonder, among other things, do we still sound that interesting? Listen carefully, and then we'll have more with the contrarian model citizen Shirley Kressel and the university eye on the town, Barry Bluestone of Northeastern. This is Open Source.
I like the way that Boston leans back in brick and stone and soot and smoke against her diminutive hills. I like the way the old red face of her peers through the blue mist in the morning and dissolves into the dark when the sun drains out of the solvent streets. I like the slant of light at midday on the thousand chimney pots on the one hand and the smoky granite on the other.
Yeah, Irish city. Real Irish and good people. Sentimental Irish.
What is they used to say, Boston, the home of the bean and the cod? Where would the Lowell speak only to Capus and the Capus speak only to God?
Cold roast Boston.
Puritanic.
Boston Brahmins.
The wasps.
Duffy people. There's a lot of snobs.
The blue laws.
I think Bostonians have a hard shell.
Unfortunately, somewhat rude.
Oh, I think the people are friendlier than we're given credit for.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The question is, where's Boston? Continued. As a new mayor, Marty Walsh takes office after 20 years of Tom Menino. Shirley Kressel from the Back Bay sets, in my view, a high standard of active intelligence as a citizen of the Republic of Boston. No reporter goes to more meetings or studies more city documents. Maybe not all the print and broadcast reporters combined watch City Hall more carefully or more critically than the housewife from Hereford Street. Shirley Kressel, welcome to Open Source.
Thanks.
Where's Boston, in your view?
Well, I think the conversation about inequality is crucial. But I really would argue that it's a symptom of even a bigger problem. And I think that we're having a crisis of governance. We have lost faith in our government, and it has not the government has lost faith in itself. In fact, the government has become corporatized. It's not only Boston, of course. It's all over the country and probably all over the world. the government has been expected to take on the business model.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of a business is to make money. The purpose of government is to spend money. The purpose of business is to sort people and find the ones that are the most useful as instruments of profit. And the government's business is to continuously keep re-leveling the playing field.
Hmm.
And when we don't have our government functioning, when the government is a partner in the business, we don't have anybody taking up that role. We don't have anybody watching for the re-leveling of opportunity.
When you say a crisis of governance, I hear a fundamental question. Is it still a democracy? Was it ever a democracy? But really, hold it up to a question of, you know, what the people rule or don't.
The democracy here is so compromised, in part by the general zeitgeist of money power, you know, a big money power over politics. In Boston, it's uniquely compromised because it's institutionally erased. We're the only city in America that's run by an authority, an independent, and that means not accountable, authority charged with serving the in real estate industry. And
I'm so glad you bring it up.
There is no check and balance against it. There's no accountability. And it has also deprived us of two of the three legs of the stool of democracy. It has totally overpowered, like over-empowered, the mayor, given him, in fact, superpowers. And it has cut out of any voice the legislative body, the city council, and the judicial branch. It has deprived us of legal recourse because it makes everything that's illegal legal, and there's no way to get at it judicially.
You know, you and I talked about this through the campaign, and I'm so glad you bring it up now. We're talking about the Boston Redevelopment Authority, which has planning and licensing powers comprehensively over real estate. I'm old enough to remember when Ed Logue inaugurated that whole game. You know, I think Kitty Craven in the Boston City Council threw a shoe at him, and Bill Foley used to swear at him. I mean, these were intensely controversial, which is to say, political contests.
She filed to abolish the BRA.
Right. And you say now it's been made sort of beyond the law, beyond politics, too. I sometimes think that the BRA is to a mayor of Boston what the CIA is to a president of the United States. They love it. It's their little private fiefdom.
It's a magic wand. And it's also the gloves. One time at a city council hearing, Paul McCann, who was, I think, then acting director, but he was always acting director, really. They asked him why was the city councilors asked the BRA why was the BRA created. You know, they created the BRA, but they don't know that anymore. And he answered, because they're so arrogant that they're not afraid. He said, well, it was created to do the dirty things and throw people off their land and still keep the mayor's hands clean. And that's what it is. It is a way for the mayor to do things that he should not do and escape political retribution. And that strikes at the very heart of democracy, because he's an overpowered, by charter and by this BRA's magic powers, executive, and he's recourse proof.
In the 60s and 70s, as I'm saying, some neighborhoods fought back, South Boston notably, and said, thank you, BRA, Ed Logue, keep out. Why is that just a totally dead letter now that you can fight the BRA?
Well,
on neighborhood issues, the city of neighborhoods.
You know, I only arrived here 20 years ago. And since I've been here, I've only seen people tackle projects, fighting projects one by one. And since I came, and because I wasn't a neighborhood person from anywhere and wasn't...
neighborhood of Toronto, as I remember.
Montreal.
Oh, yeah. Another hockey team.
Right. I would say to them, don't you see that there's a structural problem here? And you'll just be batting your head against the wall forever, one project at a time. And even if you win one, it'll be back, because basically the system, the house is going to win. The system is rigged.
Tell John Conley if how to have made it a political issue. And John, I'd love to hear your hindsight.
Well, it was ripe for that. My friends used to say, well, your life was not in vain, because now before I started yammering about this, nobody knew what the BRA was. It was just initials from City Hall. And in the last few elections, suddenly it was an issue what to do with the BRA. Of course, not people aren't talking about the right things to do with the BRA. They think they can reform it or make it more transparent or more accountable or more responsive. You cannot. This is what it was created to be. If they wanted responsive and accountable, they would have made a city department. That's why it's an authority.
From the beginning, though, it's been associated with federal money for urban renewal.
Right.
It's also been associated with sort of scandalous land clearing of the West End and this kind of thing. John, why can't it be politicized in a productive way?
I think that it was a significant issue in the race. It came up. We had forums focused strictly on it at times, certainly heard from all ends, from neighborhoods. I would agree with Shirley in the sense that, or at least knowing a lot of Shirley's work around this, that I don't think any of the candidates talked about changes in the way that she often talks about, and so probably left the debate rather unsatisfying on that end. But I will say, I think a number of the candidates, including Mayor-elect Walsh, talked about reforming the BRA.
He talked about blowing it up, and then just the other day he said, well,
never mind.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I won't speak to whatever was going on his end, but I will say that I certainly see the need for independent planning, and whether that's under the umbrella or a completely separate agency. I think that the bulk of elected officials in the city have seen that there is no check and balance. And in that regard, I agree with Shirley. I think and Council President Murphy would often say, you know, who I don't think is necessarily viewed as a reformer on this, but he would often say that the mayors get in office and they can't resist the allure of the BRA and relinquishing that type of power. I think for me, my candidacy, I tried to embody in this the notion that we needed to change much of the status quo in Boston. And the purpose and reason why ultimately went to all of this inequity. And that's whether you're talking about schools, whether you're talking about violence, whether you're talking about job creation, whether you're talking about development. My personal belief is Boston works for most people. But we forget about the people that Boston doesn't work for. And that goes to this divide. And if we don't alter the status quo in Boston, we're never going to fully reach our promise. And we're never going to reach those for whom Boston doesn't work. If you've lost a loved one to violence, Boston hasn't worked for you. If you're jobless, Boston isn't working for you.
Stick with the BRA and development issues. In New York, again, there was a contrast. The conspicuous prominence and presence of luxury high-rise housing in impoverished neighborhoods, Fort Greene in Brooklyn, for example, where these huge towers of luxury apartments are rising, like as they do in Mumbai, in Calcutta, you know, the presiding over slums. These have somehow become crystallized as political issues that have an emotional resonance. It seems to me these things are sort of approaching ripeness in Boston, but they're not here yet. And there's huge forces trying to sort of keep them off page one, keep them out of our minds. Shirley, light the fire. What should we know and what should we do?
Well, what should we know is really the question. And I'm always amazed, and I shouldn't be amazed because I know how long it took me to figure out the BRA. And I still am learning every day, new things about the BRA because it's such a black box. And people who are even talking about it in campaigns don't really understand when they say we should reform it or we should make the planning either in it or out of it. People really do not understand how this thing is structured and how it works. And I think that we have to find a way to have a public discussion, some public education. First of all, it's not true that the BRA's Boston, and it is the BRA's Boston, works for most people. The BRA is setting up a tax-granting system. Now, the BRA only qualifies them for taxes.
I just want to be clear. I didn't say the BRA's Boston works for most. I'd say Boston as just, if you're living in Boston, it's working for most people.
But I'm saying this is the BRA. I tend to say Boston is an BRA is an imperial power of which Boston is the sole colony. It runs Boston.
It makes the tax deals.
And it makes the tax deals, although the mayor actually is the granting signature on that. But the BRA qualifies it by with these bogus blight declarations. And those tax breaks are huge. I am just now, I mean literally this week, sitting down pencil to paper to try to get to the bottom with some calculations on the tax break that's coming up tomorrow for the New Boston Garden Project, the 80 Causeway Street. We are being told that there are these little tax breaks and people kind of wave it off. These are bleeding the Treasury unbelievably. If we are looking for why, you know, where do we have resources for these, you know, the poor and the housing and all the things that we never have money for, This is a huge, giant bleed in our tax base.
So much education to be done on this subject. People believe, and I do too, construction cranes are a sign of a city's health. This is good news. Look, new buildings going up. Liberty Mutual, New Boston Garden, whatever. We don't know, and it's about time we were led through it, where the benefits go.
That's right.
Tell us.
Well, Liberty Mutual is another one, got $50 million. Well, actually, now I don't even believe that that's the extent of it, because I'm learning more about how the tax breaks works. But it's how could we ever justify giving such hugely wealthy corporations the taxes of a city with a poverty rate like ours and an educational problem like ours? And one of the myths that is used to justify this is that without tax breaks, we won't have anything.
They'll go to Albuquerque New Hampshire.
Yes, they're going to build their 300-foot centennial tower in a strip mall in Dover, you know. And Liberty Mutual was at a city council hearing where John Connolly was sitting right at the front questioning them. And they plain flatly said, no, we would never consider leaving Boston. They not in a million years would have pulled up and gone anywhere else. This is where they made their fortune, and there is no way to justify that. There's no way to justify any of these subsidies to the big corporations, all of these sweetheart deals, the land deals. We should ask, why has this become what our government is? And this becomes the metric of success.
How far could you go in arguing that the BRA's business has become giving away the tax base of the city, of the people?
It was always giving away the land. And of course, their middle name is redevelopment. Their job is to get machinery out on the street. Their job is to put things through to get built and to get things through that are the bigger the better. And this is their metric of progress and success. This is how they get support from the mayors. That's a symbiotic relationship. The mayor feeds them, by the way, off the books now under the table with city land. They return the favor by making him able to promise anything and make it legal for him so that he can, you know, be a player with any developer that comes into town. The BRA works for developers, and that's another thing that Paul McCann said in public, in a public meeting. We work for developers.
But who's to say from the city to the developers that we're building a school system too? And that there are poor people who need more from this government, and you're part of the solution to the bigger problem, not just where you move or the specifics of a real estate deal.
Well, I don't like the prospect that we ask developers to help us fund public services. I mean, that's a dangerous direction.
Well, if we're building the prosperity of the city with new construction,
tax them. Let them pay taxes.
Well, exactly. That's the way you do it.
That's it. But that's not the way you do it. The way it's done now is they are given all sorts of concessions and tax breaks to build here so they can trickle down a few public benefits. And I think that John was saying in his campaign, and Walsh was saying the same thing, we're going to ask big developers to, you know, we're going to speed up their permitting so they'll give us some money for the schools or for the parks or for the libraries. I think this is a very dangerous direction to make our public service infrastructure a function of developers' philanthropic, you know, marketing program. I think that we have to have a real tax system that's fair to people, that isn't based on favoritism and backroom deals. And then we need to, the government, this is where I started, the government has to reestablish its function as the provider of public services. And it has to use its money to do that through widely agreed upon public policy, not whatever some developer happens to think will serve his purposes to get a bigger permit.
John Connolly, how does this register on your political ear?
I think the issue that matters to Bostonians are the Boston Public Schools and how they run. And I think it matters for all Bostonians because they care about the future of the city and young people getting a future, and they know it's not happening in enough cases. So I look at the Boston Public Schools as the real piece that moves here, the future of the city that's broken, not the BRA. And I think the BRA needs plenty of fixing. But that, to say that that is the single that that's eroding our tax base in the city, that's not accurate. I agree that there are deals made that lower taxes and lower the revenue piece, but it's not having a critical mass impact here relative to the city's ability to function. We can talk all about, and I know Professor Bluestone could talk a lot about the municipal finance aspect here and different directions that we need to go in here. But I think this is about a Boston Public School system that's really a city unto itself and a city that's failing bleakly. I totally respect Shirley's passion and her thought and the way she pushes the debate. But look, I believe in public-private partnerships. When Target comes to the Trotter School and builds a new library for students living in poverty and the school my daughter attends, I think that's a public-private partnership that's working, for the city. And I think we need to do that. I want a progressive tax system. I want a progressive taxation, and we definitely need to reform that. But to say that this is answered purely through taxes and then government making these decisions, that leads to a broken school system.
I want to get these stories back on page one as they used to be, and I think that's where they belong. John Conley, Shirley Kressel, stand by. The question we're playing with is, where is Boston on the eve of the Marty Walsh season in City Hall? Barry Bluestone is a labor economist and social commentator, progressive and prolific about the national and regional scenes for almost 40 years in Boston now, at Boston College, UMass Boston, and now at the Kitty and Michael Dukakis Center at Northeastern University. He leads all those studies that everybody else relies on about jobs, housing, population, race, incomes, and at the end of this last mayor's race, about inequality. Barry, where are we going?
Well, let's look at where we started. I arrive in Boston in 1971, a little earlier than Shirley. It was one of the most unwelcoming cities you could imagine. After 4 years here, I'm walking across the Boston
College campus.
A cold Irish town. And, I'm white. And I'm walking across our campus, and one of our older priests hails me across, a good old Irish priest at Boston College, says, "How you doing, Bluestone?" And I said, "Father, I'm doing wonderfully. 4 years I've been in Boston. I love the city. I love Boston College. I love New England. But I must tell you, Father, 4 years, it still doesn't feel like home." And this old, wonderful priest turned to me and put his arm around me and says, "Don't you worry, Bluestone. In 3 or 4 generations, you're going to fit right in." That was Boston then. And then 2 years later, the city blows up over school busing. A bigoted, unwelcome, cold city. I'm glad that's behind us, for the most part. Much more diverse city, a city in which a majority of our citizens are people of color, a city in which more and more people are feeling welcome, including young people coming here. The good news is, when I got here from Detroit, Detroit was a boomtown compared to Boston. Mm. Today, of course, Boston is one of the richest cities in the country, in the world. That's all good. The problem is, where is Boston going now? And the problem that I see is that we're becoming a city because of the cost of housing, the cost of living, of which we're getting what we call a bimodal distribution. We've got the rich. We've got low-income people who might be able to afford public housing or a Section 8 voucher. But we're losing all the working families. 35% of all the housing in Greater Boston, Boston, Somerville, Watertown, Waltham, Cambridge, where I live, are the old triple-deckers and the duplexes, built between the late 19th and early 20th century for workers. Since 2009, just 4 years ago, the cost of a triple-decker unit has gone up by 46%. Rents continue to rise every single year but one during the Great Recession. And what's happening?
And who's moving into them?
What's moving in is we've got lots of young people coming here. That's a blessing. We need young people to take the place of older folks like me and maybe you. I won't say anything about Shirley. But the fact is that we've got young people coming here. There are graduate students. They're my graduate students at Northeastern. There are young medical interns and residents, young professionals in biotech and all these great things. They're ganging up, 3-4, getting together and buying or renting, sometimes buying a unit in these triple-deckers. It's gone from working housing to housing for our young graduate students. Mm. we have a lot of trouble building new housing for working families. $400,000 a unit, given land costs and construction costs. But we need to build a lot of new housing, smaller housing, more appropriate housing for young people, clear them out of those triple-deckers, at least some of them, so that we can start having a place where working families can stay here mm-hmm. again. If we don't do that, 10 years from now, we're going to have a wonderful city for the very wealthy. We'll have a city that's not very good for the poor, and there won't be anybody in between. That's what this new mayor has to deal with.
This is fascinating. I mean, you've got a villain finally, the graduate student, and yet the graduate student embodies every hope, every proud thing we think about this town. People come from Bangladesh, from all over the states, Europe, Latin America, to study here and to get the polish that Barack Obama cited that he and Michelle both got as kids. What was it? The '80s. I mean, that is what we love most. And yet, as you suggest, the universities don't have dormitories for graduate students.
Exactly. Harvard has some. MIT has some. We have none. BU has none. Boston College has none. What we need to do, and I hope the mayor and in the last year of his governorship, Deval Patrick, will get together and pull together the universities, the teaching hospitals, and say, look, you're tax exempt. You're getting away with very low pilot payment in lieu of taxes. You owe something back to the city. We want your young people here. They give us vibrancy. They keep the city young. But we need to find housing for them, and you have to be part of the answer. You have to get together with developers and put up housing for young people that's appropriate. Probably smaller units, lots of nice amenities. But make it possible for our young students to have a choice between three or four of them renting a duplex or a triple-decker and new housing for them, and then free up housing that was built for working people explicitly, but which is disappearing from their
possibility. I can't mention New York, Barry, but, you know, under Bloomberg, they've experimented with modular housing, inexpensive micro housing, drop-in housing. Is that possible here?
I think it is. But I think what we have to do is really open our eyes to a whole lot of possibilities. I mean, some people want to just pop up these hundreds or thousands of these little micro units. We need something much more exciting than that.
Speaking of opening your eyes, there's something I'm dying to mention to all of you, and that's this series in the New York Times last week, I can't remember anything like it. 5 days, 3 pages every day on a girl named Dasani, named after the bottled water. A child of drug addicts, 12 years old. No, 9 years old, I think. But the point was simply, the New York Times, it was like watching The Wire turn up on the New York Times. Completely different emphasis on the desperately poor, the 22,000 homeless children in New York, 50,000 homeless people. This was in Fort Greene, but it's a citywide phenomenon. But suddenly, I felt maybe under the pressure of the de Blasio turn in the conversation in New York, but the New York Times was suddenly saying, wait a sec, there are these other people, desperately poor, neglected, incredibly resourceful, promising in many, many ways, but that we've got to turn our attention in a different way. I wonder what it would take to undergo that kind of a brain shift around here.
Well, you know, I think it is critical that we take, we keep our eye on the ball. We keep thinking about the people who are at the very bottom of our society, the homeless in the worst condition of all, and particularly families with young children. But I think the new mayor, the city council, the state has to think much more broadly, because there are a lot of people who are feeling pressure of this economy. We've had an economy in which we've seen the stock market take off, rising to all-time levels. We see corporate executives coming home with massive bonuses of millions of dollars. We have workers who work every day. They're not homeless. We have workers who are working every day of the year to put food on the table to try and afford rents. We have a quarter of Boston's renter population is spending more than 50% of their income each year just on rent. Now, they're not in the poverty statistics, and their kids are not homeless, but they are feeling terrible disadvantage in this city. And ultimately, Many of them leave because they can't afford the place. We don't want to kick people out of the city. We need them. We want them. It's their city, too. And we have to find a way of bringing the cost of living down, starting with housing, with health care. We have to think about ways of improving the schools so those folks will stay here and their kids will get the best education, as good as Brookline, as good as Newton, as good as the private schools. Those are the things we have to do, not just for the desperately poor and the homeless, but for tens, actually, maybe another 100, 200,000 more.
Let me ask you all, there's a notion out there that, in fact, in history and maybe today, mayors are ideally situated to report on reality and to surface, I mean, in the tradition of LaGuardia, I suppose, or James Michael Curley in Boston, or Bill de Blasio today, to remind us where we are in ways that Washington won't tell us and national candidates, senatorial candidates, don't like to think about. Is that real? Is it romantic? What can a mayor actually do about taxes, for example, John, or even about, you know, these giant metropolitan questions? I would argue that he can surface the issues. He can talk. It's a wonderful bully pulpit. He can say anything he wants.
Yep. I think it's the best position that there is for an elected official to make a difference. And I think we look at our politics today, look at the Congress paralyzed, our president paralyzed. And I think in Massachusetts, the state legislature largely paralyzed. But the mayor in a city, but the mayor of Boston in particular, and this is the flip side of the coin. I agree with Shirley that the BRA and the city charter combined to make this mayor position all powerful in many senses. But that also enables a mayor to raise the consciousness, to change issues, and to change the status quo if the mayor chooses, by really driving programmatic change throughout the city. A mayor can be an incredibly bold and powerful leader who could become, in a sense, the standard bearer for truly addressing these issues that plague all American cities and all of our society around the great inequity. So I think a mayor can make a tremendous difference with what they do. And I'll just say, you know, lastly, with some of Barry's points here, this is all connected. You know, you can't talk about job creation if you're not talking about transportation. You can't talk about transportation if you're not talking about housing. And you can't talk about any of these if you're not talking about education. And you can't talk about education if you're not talking about supporting and strengthening families. It's all connected at the end of the day. And we've got to see that the graduate student and the software engineer, their fate and future in Boston is directly connected to the recent immigrant from Cape Verde who comes with not a dime in their pocket and is just trying to get their foot in the door and build a better future for their child in this city. And if we don't recognize those connections, and if we don't have bold leadership in the mayor's office, then we're going to continue to be a Boston that, as I would say, I know Shirley would disagree, but works for many, the affluent, but doesn't work for a whole group of people who turn, in a sense, invisible because they're not vested in the power structure. And so I do agree. A mayor can address these issues, and a bold mayor could conceivably make a difference nationally in how we change these issues.
That's a venerable idea in Boston itself. I mean, James Michael Curley was an emperor in his own right. John Collins was a superb political chieftain. Kevin White modeled on John Collins from the notion that it's the ideal job. It's a talker's job. It's a teacher's job. No legislator to fight. You're on your own. And these people, Bloomberg among them, can make this job. John Lindsay, think of what he dramatized in the 60s. Make the speech, Shirley. Where does he start talking?
You know, I think that the mayor is, and the mayors in general, are caught up in a different kind of vision that is a leftover from urban renewal days when cities were being bereft and people were fleeing. And it seems to me that the urban renewal drive of, you know, towers and that's what's progress.
Negro removal, as it was called.
Negro removal. And all of this is the spirit of that is still with us, that the mayor gets glory not from doing all these things that John says correctly are interconnected and large systemic problems for the masses. The mayor gets glory from the things that he is massively empowered to do, by the structure, because that's the value system of the times, and poor people don't fit in that. They're not the glittery stuff is really sucking up all the oxygen, and it takes up the politicians' attention, and the fact that they can announce groundbreakings and the tallest tower and the we've invested so much in job creation by giving tax breaks, which is false entirely. But this whole thing that mayors are up to now is to remake the city from what it used to be, and that really takes attention away from all of these issues and all of these people and focuses it on the 1% and what they need.
But there's a tension here, which is that I think oftentimes we do get champions for the poor. And certainly Mayor Curley was known as the mayor of the poor. Ray Flynn was certainly branded as a mayor for poor Bostonians. The question is, though, do those champions initiate regressive policies? And I'd agree, we need a mayor with a forward-looking vision. And I hope Mayor Walsh will be this mayor, by the way. I don't think we know yet, but who will embrace progressive policies and really maybe some new thinking, but prioritize the right way. And I take your point to heart, Shirley. Do you prioritize for the powerful or do you prioritize for the powerless? And listen, America can come in here and change the housing policy. Say, listen, we're not going to build and prioritize luxury condominiums. We are going to prioritize both affordable, but the other place we're missing, which is workforce and middle market and the real middle class housing. And a mayor can do that. The question is, will a mayor have the real fortitude to take that battle on?
Barry, I'm wondering, who's to say Marty Walsh can't do it? And what are the pressures? Who are the people he's got to hear from to encourage him? I mean, in many ways, he's a thoroughly sympathetic character. He was known as a progressive at the State House. He has very empathetic connections to, shall we say, the recovery community. He's a thoroughly decent guy. Where do we find him, backbone he needs?
Marty comes out of a working class family. He was the head of a major union. He understands what working families face. The real question now is, will Marty be able to convert his deep ingrained understanding of workers and the problems they face into policies that will help make it possible for folks to stay here and live a better life? He's got to do that on housing. He's got to do that on transportation. He absolutely has to do it on education. And I think there are policies that all kinds of people are now telling him he has to implement. He's got transition teams that are looking at housing, education, economic development, what to do with the BRA, what to do with health. That's great. And he's pulling people in from all over the communities. I really applaud him for that. The real question is, after inaugural day, can he take
Which
all of that advice?
Which will be paid for by none of those people.
Well, we'll see how it will get paid for. And paying for it is going to be very difficult. I'm not as worried. I don't think we need to give all these tax giveaways, but it's a tiny part of the tax total taxes.
He makes interesting noises, Barry, if I interrupt, about the arts, for example, to minority communities. I mean, yep. A lot of the sounds are good. Maybe what he really needs is to be reminded that the people who elected him are precisely those working class good
Absolutely.
People who are being forced out by the graduate school invasion of the three decades that were built for them.
What I think he can do, using the bully pulpit, is he has to pull people together, and he has to bring construction firms, and he's got to bring developers, for-profit and non-profit. He's got to bring the universities, the teaching hospitals. He's got to bring them all together and say, look, guys, and they're mostly guys, these are the problems we face. We need you to help solve them. We've got some great institutions here, which unfortunately cities like Detroit do not have. We have great foundations like the Boston Foundation on the forefront of a lot of the great policies. We've got some great corporations that are quite progressive. We've got to get them all together, and the mayor can bring them together to begin solving these problems.
And we'll talk about them here on Open Source. Thank you all. Barry Bluestone, Shirley Kressel, John Conley. Special thanks to Cambridge 7 Associates and Peter Chermayev for the sound from that film from 1976, Where is Boston? That wonderful bicentennial documentary of the eternal spirit of the town. We'll have a link to the video at our website, radioopensource.org. Our show is produced by Mary McGrath with help from Kunal Jasti and George Hicks. I'm Christopher Lydon, inviting you to visit us at radioopensource.org and become part of this new project. Thank you.